service-connected disability benefits in August 2006.
And did you make a determination on either of those issues, Linda?
Whether,
or is that what you're saying? There was kind of a non-decision, no decision.
There was no decision, and so me coming in last a little over a year ago, I again reevaluated the merits of the claim because we had this pending litigation, and could have at that point approved the claim. We wouldn't be having this discussion today, but I didn't think that that would be appropriate.
Because
I felt that had the process been different under the old board, where and as it is now, then a denial would have been issued once the evaluation of the claim was completed, an actual decision would be made. The claim would have been accepted or approved or denied within a specific period of time.
I'm just I guess the part that's disturbing me is, having lived through these wars on a variety of levels, I'm disturbed that I'm being asked to make a decision that is more appropriately made at the fund, where all of the facts are his filed, his history. I don't have any of that. And I'm reluctant to agree to something, not because I don't agree that it's a good settlement, but I actually might conclude that after having the benefit of reviewing the file, that maybe his claim should have been approved. But I'm not in a position to make a decision on either because of the lack of information I have. And I guess one of the things I was hoping would happen in this new system is that when we got items on appeal like this, you would be able to sit and characterize to us why you denied the claim.
Right.
And that's not what I'm hearing.
I think that, we have had, to a certain extent, this is only the second settlement that I've been involved with. It's involved kind of this joint FPDNR and a city settlement agreement. We do have, we had a few situations that basically were from the past that, we needed to figure out what to do with them and get them resolved so the system can move forward.
True.
With the new, with the new system in place and the new rules in place, I do think that, claims that if they were to come to you today and were claims that have been filed since the implementation of the new system, there would be greater clarity for
true.
You.
But I hope you can, if not agree, at least respect what I'm trying to articulate.
Oh,
and
yes.
That is, am I creating a process that wasn't envisioned at the time we reformed the charter that allows very controversial decisions to be kicked to the council to decide and that the staff nor the board wants to get involved with, and that you're arguing that, yeah, but this is an exception because it's an old claim, doesn't hold water because it falls under the processes just exactly like a new claim would. In my view, I don't understand why we wouldn't adjudicate that and let the facts fall where they may. I mean, if he qualifies, he qualifies for the claim. If he doesn't, he doesn't. And we use the process. And what I, there might be some small amount of irony in the position I'm taking, but if we're going to establish a credible system with voters, I think we ought to let the system work. And this feels a little bit like, and I'm not saying that this is the way it is. I'm open to being challenged by you if I'm thinking about this wrong. But it feels like I am allowing the system to be a little bit abbreviated by agreeing to something here without having all the facts and actually feeling as though I don't think we were envisioned to be the fact finders or the arbiters of contentious claims, of which I'm very familiar with, by the way, having sat on the board for 12 years and sat through an era of a lot of stress claims. Those are really hard decisions to make, and I appreciate how challenging that is. I also don't appreciate being back in that position, having left that spot, and hoping you all did what your job requires you to do. So I'm just having some deep reservations of just procedurally about agreeing to this settlement.
I guess one thing that maybe I could add that may bring some additional clarity to it is for me, having come from the risk management system and having similar situations that would be brought before you that were workers' compensation claims, which is comparable to the service-connected claim. Other than issuing a formal denial, the process that we've gone through is consistent with that process that we would go through under that program prior to bringing it to council for your consideration. So if there's some additional information that going forward that we should be aware of that would help to better educate council, if you will, on kind of the history and bring more clarity to what our recommendation is, then that would be very much appreciated.
I've had all the history I can take for one lifetime with this. And I mean, my bigger point is that I feel like I'm being asked to make a decision that more rightfully should be made at the fund, and where you had the benefit of the entire file and the entire context within which this discussion is being made, within which this discussion is happening. And that's just my, I don't know if I'm the only one who feels like that here, but I think
that not the only one.
I think that I'm, and now I feel stronger. Having heard Dan feel the way I do, I don't know. I'm not actually questioning whether the claim is good or not good. I don't know. I just feel as though we created a system that went through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to be done, and some of which I didn't like, but in the end it passed, and I supported, and feels not like what I agreed to.
Can I, Commissioner Leonard, can I ask a question piggybacking on your comments? Because you're raising a fundamental policy question, and what is our role? And I, frankly, I had focused more on how I would review the recommendations and the stuff we reviewed from council, and so that the policy question, though, is important to me. So is this particular matter time-sensitive in some way?
It's time-sensitive in that they are in the process. They have had two pre-hearing conferences, and the next step would be to schedule the case for hearing, as I understand it, with outside counsel.
But, for example, if – because there's two issues I'm hearing here. One is about process and about – how we got here, and the other one is about the merits of a proposed settlement. And if I don't see how we can resolve the process question just by talking about it here, I mean, that's a question where Commissioner Leonard has raised some issues, which I'd frankly like to know more about before I get to the merits of the settlement. But if no hearing's been scheduled, then technically we could set this over if we chose and have further consultation with counsel on some of those questions before it came back to address the merits of the claim. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we could wait. I mean, you talk about a hearing being scheduled.
Yeah.
To determine the service-connected disability benefits and also the return-to-work issue.
Well, the determination of non-service benefits. Those would be the two issues to be heard by
Those would be made moot if we approve the settlement, right?
Oh, if you approve the settlement, then it would resolve all of those issues. There would be no hearing, and Mr. Bellotta would retire.
But in terms of scheduling a hearing, while that's the next step, you have to agree to a hearing. So there's no pending hearing date that's been scheduled.
Since I'm not the lawyer who is handling the hearing process, FPDNR has outside counsel who's been handling the hearing. As I understand it, they don't have a hearing scheduled. I know that they set over another conference call about the hearing last week because this was coming to counsel. So if counsel decided to postpone and have further discussion, and postpone approval of the settlement, then I imagine they will work that into their processing.
I'm not hearing that if we don't act today, there's some drastic consequence. And I just want you to know that when a fundamental question of process is raised about what is our role, I don't think, frankly, we should do that on the fly and just, you know, try to come to some accommodation if we're not operating under a time constraint. Because until that issue is resolved, I don't see how we can appropriately then get to the merits of what's been suggested. And so I'm inclined to, if there's agreement on the council, to set this over so we can have further consultation with council, with council, excuse me.
I had a couple of questions before we get to that point, and I'd like to talk about the process. Does the new FPDNR charter change require FPDNR to go through with the hearing?
Yes.
And so to not do that would be contrary to the charter? I want to make sure I'm hearing your answer correctly.
Well, there is some. Actually, it's in the administrative rules. Those that were in place, those most recent to the charter reform, where they actually put some time frames around how long a hearing could be postponed. How long that had been in effect, I just don't know. But the current process going through the Office of Administrative Hearings and what that whole administrative process is very structured. And at the outmost, a hearing possibly could be postponed for up to a year and a half, but there would have to be some extreme circumstances that would cause that to occur.
But does the charter allow you to intervene and request or determine if there's a settlement that could be agreed to sort of postpone a hearing that the city could either win or lose? Do you have the legal authority to bring the situation to us as you have today,
yes,
to agree to a settlement?
Yes, I do have that authority.
That's in order to not have the hearing go forward because of the potential consequences.
That's correct.
I'm not sure where the problem is with the process.
Well, because the only part that I would question about your inquiry is, I guess I would understand that if you denied the claim, but what I'm hearing has happened is there has been no adjudication on the claim at the fund. And the larger point I'm making is that it strikes me, first of all, as unusual on a claim that's 9 years old to be told that there has been no adjudication. The other part that bothers me that I've just learned is that if in July of 2006, his benefits stopped. My recollection of the way the rules work is he is directed to return to duty, and it would appear that for some 2.5 years he has been absent without leave. And what has the city done about that? I mean, it sounds to me like he's abandoned his job.
I cannot answer that question because I don't know.
Well, I mean, at that point in time, if you'll recall, we were actually in the process of launching the Return to Work program, and which was to identify individuals who were capable of coming to work in either a full duty or restricted duty capacity. And I know that Mr. Bellotto was identified as one individual who could come back. And there was quite a bit of processing that was going on. And I know that the Police Bureau has been waiting pending settlement discussions to give him an order to return to work.
So he has not been ordered to?
He has not been ordered to return to work.
What's his status that for 2.5 years he's essentially been a non-employee?
Well,
what do we call that when a person has no authorized leave, is not on any kind of leave, essentially has abandoned their post? What do we call that?
Well, it gets somewhat complicated when an individual is off on leave when there's disputes about whether or not the person is capable of working. If the employee's doctor says that the person is not capable of working, and I would say, when I say we, understand that at the time, things like independent medical evaluations that might be maintained by FPDNR are not documents that the bureaus would have in their files.
Yes,
and so that wouldn't, I mean.
But Stephanie, I mean, I was on the fund for 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
I sat through a lot of hearings where there were disputes that were resolved by independent medical exams. And consistently, when an employee lost, they were ordered to return to duty. And that happened more than, I mean, there's...
That's a question.
Yeah.
I don't mean to argue with them. Just
yeah, and I don't mean to argue with you either. I think some of this is because, you know, both Linda and I are kind of, we weren't here when all of this sort of started and things were happening, and so so some of it is trying to sort through all the pieces of what we actually know and what are pieces that we're sort of pulling.
I think this exchange has been useful. My question is sort of what message does this send to other city employees that you cannot show up to work for extended period of time, for extended periods of time, and we will continue to pay you? And then if you file a stress-related claim, we will settle with you.
Well, you know, we've settled a number of disputed claims over the years.
Do we have many city
employees?
Do we have many city employees that have not shown up to work for years that we continue to pay?
Well, I want to remind you that from 2000 to 2006, FPDR did pay a non-service disability benefit. There was time loss authorized by Mr. Bellotta's
position. How long has he been off of that but being paid and not showing up to work on some other program?
He's not been paid in the last 2 years since FPDNR stopped paying him.
July 2006.
I think it was August 2006. Yeah, and he has not been paid since then.
And this agreement makes his retirement date then effective, was it the 1st of September 2006?
Yes.
Correct.
So that it's contiguous to that ending of the his medical leave. As I remember, the return to work program said that you could return to work, but you had to be recertified if you'd been gone longer than, is it 2.5 or 5 years?
Yeah, under the state Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which certifies police officers, they require that if a person has been absent from work more than 2.5 years, then they have to attend a career officer training program. And if an officer has actually been off work for more than 5 years, then they have to go back and repeat the basic police officer academy. So those are the rules that are required by the state. So what the Portland Police Bureau would have to look at in returning a person who's been off on medical leave for some time is how long has the person been off on leave, and what do we need to do in order to bring this person into compliance with the state training standards. So those would have been issues that certainly would have been considered. And I'm remembering one other piece of information that might be useful for Commissioner Leonard's sake. I do understand that there actually was a letter that was sent to Mr. Bellotta that indicated he'd been medically separated from employment because he wasn't able to come to work according to his medical provider at some point. And with the return to work program, of course, we were starting to reverse medical separations and recall people back. So,
but if they had been gone more than 5 years, which Sergeant Bellotta had been gone more than 5 years, they would have to go back to the basic academy, including all of the physical parts of the academy.
That's correct.
Self-defense tactics, et cetera. Was it determined if Sergeant Bellotta could actually complete that physical part of going back to the academy?
I don't know if a determination was made, but just logically, I think the position that the Portland Police Bureau would take is that if the medical information from FPDNR is that this person is capable of performing police officer duties, then they would have sent him back to the basic academy to perform basic academy and become fully certified as a police officer. That's the logical extent of the, if you play out, you know, what the medical information was. And then there would be a dispute there, of course, because Mr. Blatt's doctor didn't believe that he could perform police officer duties and presumably be certified.
If for any reason, whether it's because of Bellotta's attorney or medical provider, said that he could not perform, but if he did not go back to the basic academy, then he would not be certified under the state law certifying who is and who is not a police officer. So thus he could not actually perform the duties of a police officer. Is that correct?
That's correct. State law requires DPSST certification.
But are you saying that at that point in 2006 that the independent medical evaluator determined that he was capable of coming back to work, and that would have included going back and performing basic academy at the state DPSST?
I think that's how the Portland Police Bureau would have to look at it, yes.
What happened at that point? I mean, why wasn't he? Because I remember we were working very hard to get as many of those officers back to work as possible. We even had a list of who we thought could come back.
Again, my recollection of that is that some negotiations between FPDNR and Mr. Bellotta about their two disputes had begun, and we were asked to hold off until those discussions could be completed. And then following that, we had the charter reform. We had numerous transitions within FPDNR. And so it just went along until we could try to complete negotiations. And we have had numerous attempts over the last 12 months to try to negotiate these claims and finally reached this tentative settlement in a mediation with a professional mediator last month. So,
if we turn this down or table it or set it over, then this will proceed to a hearing.
Not necessarily.
If you turn this down, this will proceed to a hearing. Right. Yes, and then the Portland Police Bureau will need to look at the employment pieces.
If we set it over along the lines that Commissioner Fish talked about, that's another option.
Set it over to discuss sort of the procedural part of things?
There are procedural issues, but there are also issues covered by attorney-client privilege, which we're not allowed to raise in this public forum. So I would support a motion to set over so that I could learn more about the policy question that Commissioner Leonard has raised and get a briefing on that. But that has in turn raised some other issues which are covered by an attorney-client privilege, which I'd like to discuss with the city attorney.
Second.
I agree.
We have a motion. Second. Okay, call a vote.
Adams?
You don't need to set it over. There's not a vote, is there, Ben?
What time period is the council considering? In the motion itself, what's the time period for the set over?
2 weeks.
Well, is 2 weeks enough? I mean, and perhaps we would want to give some clarification to FPDNR as to what is the policy issue that we're looking at. I'm trying to figure out what the policy issue is.
It's very clear in my mind. We're getting this not based on an appeal of a denial. There's been no decision made one way or the other on the case, and I have a problem with that.
But she said she had the authority to bring it to the council. So that's
that's part of the question that I'm not clear about. I mean, I don't want there to be a precedent set where difficult claims are kicked to us. I mean, I think they need to adjudicate them, and then if the charter allows for an appeal to us, I understand that's my role. I didn't know I was signing up for hearings here that the fund decided they didn't want to decide.
But is this a transition issue between the two systems, or does this set a precedence?
A lot of the information that they're presenting occurred prior to the...
So, Stephanie, maybe you could help us up here.
As I understand, it doesn't change what the process is.
Maybe I should just clarify.
Under the charter, the city council's role is... It states that the fund administrator, with the approval of the city council, shall have the authority to settle and discharge all or part of its future obligations to any member, spouse, or beneficiary of a member for disability benefits as to any and all claims or entitlements to disability benefits as part of a settlement. So the fund administrator has the authority to settle disability claims with city council approval.
I don't think that general authority has ever been in question, because we would always have the right, but I think Commissioner Leonard's point is after some official action has been taken that we can then react to. And I would suggest that we set this over for 4 weeks. There is no hearing scheduled.
But what the charter says is that this is part of the process, that it's not a requirement to have a decision The recommendation coming from FPDNR, which is their decision, is to settle this case.
And that may be, and all I'm saying is that you may be correct that that's what the charter allows. I'm not comfortable with that process. I mean, I want to send the message that I want them to make an adjudication to the claim, and then if there's an appeal that comes to us, fine, but I don't want to start this thing where we start doing settlements that for whatever reason the fund doesn't want to decide.
If the charter allows for it, whether we're comfortable with it or not.
Well, you can vote yes and I can vote no. I mean, that's my position. That's where I'm at.
You can either approve that the fund administrator has the authority to settle this, or you can say that she doesn't. And in either case, appeals of and the merits of the claims aren't things that come to your attention as part of the process.
I wouldn't describe it quite that way. We can decide on this particular case whether we want to take her
recommendation.
Her recommendation. Right.
In this particular case.
We have.
If not, then it goes and finishes the normal old process, right?
It would finish not under the old process, under the new administrative hearings process with the state hearings office.
And we've been told that there's risk associated with that. I think what we're trying to do is to figure out, is that worth the risk, or should we take the recommendation?
But my point is, I don't know, because all I know is what I'm being told here. I don't have the benefit of the file to look at.
So setting it over allows us to, each of us, review the confidential individual file.
And I would suggest that we set it over for a four-week period. Because, as I understand, since no hearing has been set, we can have some confidence that we won't get jammed on the time.
Stephanie.
I agree.
Stephanie, Linda, did you want to make a statement?
I did, and I wanted to ask Stephanie a question. Do you think that this may, by setting it over for 4 weeks, may impact our opportunity if the council later does approve the settlement?
Can I just say, as a recovering attorney, if you have a former Supreme Court justice who acted as a mediator and has got the parties to put points and authorities in paper, and the message of the council is they would like a little more time to evaluate the proposal on the merits, my hunch is that it won't result in any detriment to the proposal, provided we don't get jammed on the time of a hearing.
But that's not the point that Commissioner Leonard is making. He's concerned about the process, not the merits of the case.
Well, if you hear what I'm saying, the context of what I'm saying is, if you're not making a recommendation to me, then I have no basis upon which to decide whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. I said earlier that I may well look at the file and agree that he should have gotten a retroactive service-connected disability to 1999. I don't know if, in looking at the file, I can read, which, by the way, I will do very reluctantly. I was hoping never have to do such a thing again.
Right.
But having been put in a position where I'm going to do that, I'll do what it is I would have thought the fund would have done, looked at the file, and make a judgment as to whether or not it was a good claim or not.
Well,
and then vote based on that.
The fund did do that since I've been there. That's what I've done.
On the non-service.
On the service claim. The non-service claim was approved back in 2000.
Okay.
The board approved the non-service claim. I reviewed the service claim during the past year and have determined that it would not be appropriate to approve the claim, which is why we're in the litigation.
But did you deny it?
I did not issue a formal denial because, again, this claim comes from the prior form of evaluation, and it's in the new system now. I guess I could have issued a tool, but in that the claim had not been approved, just like under the prior system where it was set over for hearing rather than approving or denying the claim initially. In all intents and purposes, the claim is currently denied. There just has not been an actual formal document or notification to the member that the claim has been denied.
So, Linda, I just need to understand more. What was the reason? Why didn't you deny the claim? The non-denial denial?
Well, you know, there were a number of claims that had been set over for hearing that were in existence from the prior form of evaluation that had not been approved, and the member had, of course, challenged that because the individual felt that they're eligible for benefits or entitled to benefits, and there was no formal denial issued on those claims. We just went through the hearings process. We have heard several claims that are cases that were incurred prior to the reform.
Right.
There was no formal denial issued on the claim.
But why wouldn't you move to a formal denial? What you did a non-denial denial for some reason, as opposed to a formal denial.
I think prior to the new system, the way that, as I understand the structure worked, is that if a member filed a claim for service-connected benefits, and the staff that reviewed the claim they didn't have the authority, and there weren't rules in place where they actually denied claims the way they do now. What would happen is that they just would not approve the claim, and then the matter would go to the full board of trustees for a hearing on whether or not to approve the claim. So
you're acting consistent with past practice.
How that had been handled on these particular cases that arose under that old system.
But under the new system, there would be there'd be some action taken, and then it would go to a hearing officer.
Correct.
And
yes.
I would think under the new system that a hearing officer might be persuaded by that a relevant piece of the hearing officer's inquiry is whether there's been a denial or not by a fact finder prior to the hearing. And a hearing officer might even want to give some level of deference to that. So I don't know how the new system works, but I'm guessing a hearing officer would be interested in knowing whether it's been approved or denied.
Part of the crux of your concern. And part of the crux of your concern is
it? Haven't we been notified that we're being sued by six members of the fund on issues very similar to this about return to work and receiving disability payments?
We've received a complaint that's filed by, I'm not the attorney litigating the case. I believe there are four firefighters who have filed litigation against the city associated with essentially being directed to return to work through the return to work
program. So there's some precedential value, I think, with how we handle this case, potentially.
Well, I disagree. Is that those four firefighters are basing it on the current FPDNR changes. Is that correct?
Those individuals, as I understand it, actually were cleared by their own medical professionals to actually return to work in the restricted duty jobs.
I don't want to digress here, but
I think it's a different fact situation.
So if I could ask, what is the downside? If the council has a preference for you to formally, I want to make sure I get the right, adjudicate your decision on this claim, if we just have a preference, call it our intuition.
Sure.
What is the potential downside of that? I just want to make sure I'm fully aware.
If there's an adjudication by FPDNR to actually issue a
notice of denial. Claim denial.
This isn't an adjudication. This is request to pay the claim or settlement prior to adjudication from a hearings officer.
Correct.
That would be the next step. And what you're saying in terms of risk analysis, it's better to make this decision at this point, and you've made the decision. Now we either have to confirm it or deny it. Make that decision so that we can not go to the hearings and face further risk.
It will be a much greater financial burden to the taxpayers of this city to hearing and not prevail.
If I might, the settlement also involves the release of potential claims for which the city has received notice by Mr. Bellotta. So it is a release. The risk is twofold. One is to FPDNR, and the other is to the city. And
right.
The city is part of this settlement and is obtaining a release of claims as against the city at a fairly significant.
And I know because I was barged in on the mayor recently, and he was very dutifully reading the claim background, which I have not read, that was this thick. So you've read through that, and I think I need to do that as well, and I apologize for not having the time to do that prior to this particular meeting. But I just want to, so I like the holdover just to get familiar.
You haven't been given it, so.
Right, but we can get a hold of that, right? We're allowed to look at that?
I'll have to consult with the FPD and our attorneys to make sure that that's the case.
So assuming we can get access to that.
Assuming you can.
I just want to make sure. So the risk of us asking you to make a determination that would then go on to, could be appealed to a hearings officer, or we just go to a hearings officer and they decide denial or approval?
That's correct. I mean, either way, I mean, at this point, we can issue an instrument that says that the claim has been denied. But again, for all intents and purposes, that's already occurred. The language in the settlement document acknowledges that the claim is not.
And you've given us that information before, so we're in the lightning round here.
Yes.
I'll try to frame my questions for short answers. thank you for being patient with us.
No problem.
So the potential downside of you sending a letter of denial is it could be appealed, and in that appeal, we could lose.
It's already in the appeals process.
It's in the appeals process,
and
if that continues, then we could lose money.
This is to shortstop that.
Okay. Do we set a precedent? So this is one of those in-between cases, right?
Yes.
It was on the old system. It's going to be settled after the reform.
Yes.
I would like to know, not necessarily today, but during the holdover, how many other potential claims are there? So that's an area of questions I'm interested in getting
from other individuals.
Correct. Are there any other in-betweens? And in our council potential actions on these issues, or FPD&R actions on these in-between claims, do we set any sort of precedence for the new system moving forward and claims within the new system? So are we doing cleanup here, or are we unintentionally setting some sort of precedence with claims under the new system? I'd be interested in answers to those two areas of questions.
Could you answer them now? To me, this is a unique fact situation. I'm unaware of any other police claim that is even similar, that it's founded in one FPD in our system and has rolled over into the new one, and that there's a lot of unresolved issues. What I felt this was doing was resolving the issues through a settlement rather than take the risk of going to a hearing.
So this is cleanup for...
I don't know about the numbers, but I considered this to be a cleanup.
And do you have any initial thoughts in terms of, does this set precedence for a desire to have a much more transparent, fair for all involved system under the new reforms? Does this set any sort of unintended precedent?
I have to give thought to that.
I would not think so. I'm very well aware of any action that you may take on a claim in this respect could send an unintended message. I'm very well aware of that, but I think because of the age of this claim, the uniqueness of all the issues that are associated with the claim, the fact that we have gone from one system to another system, and knowing that the actual administrative review will be done probably very different than had it been the review been before the Board of Trustees, I think increases our risk of being responsible for dollars that are far greater than what we can pay now to resolve all of the issues.
As the author of the motion to set over, can I just again just state succinctly, Mayor, my purpose? I'm agnostic on the policy question because I don't know enough to make a judgment. I think Ms. Harper has done an excellent job in her memo to us outlining the risk assessment, and it's within, to me, the boundaries of what we normally get on risk assessment, so that's been helpful to me. And I've learned in the course of this hearing that a setover will not cause any prejudice to the process since no hearing is scheduled. So just speaking for myself, the benefit of a setover would allow me to confer with counsel and learn more about this process and make a more informed decision. It should not be construed as any way a criticism of how we got here or a specific statement about how I think we should go forward. But it would give the newest member a chance to learn more about this process and to consider arguments raised in this hearing.
Okay, we'll do it only for you because you got to go.
Okay. I think the motion has been made and seconded.
Is it a motion or do we just ask that it be set over for?
We could probably just ask for it to be set over, correct, Ben?
That's generally the process, so no vote would be necessary if the council is in agreement on a set over.
We set it over then for 4 weeks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sorry, Mayor, we had a request
for
testimony.
Who did wish to testify. Is he signed up?
Oh, I didn't have a sign-up sheet. This was pulled from consent.
Okay, please come forward.
And Mr. Monk.
Good morning, Mr. Mayor, Commissioner.
Please sit down and state your name for the record, sir.
I'm Michael Monk.
You have 3 minutes.
I have 3 minutes. Thank you very much. I'm here to present a view of a Portland voter and taxpayer on this issue based on solely my reading of the Oregonian's article about this and the testimony that I've heard here this morning. The discussion has been focused strictly on the process, but I'd like to suggest that there is a issue of substance here that Portland taxpayers need to be aware of. I have no connection with Sergeant Belanda or his attorney or anyone else, and I have no other information to give you than the views of a concerned taxpayer. My understanding of the case is that Sergeant Belanda was charged with corruption in allowing police officers to work on overtime without actually getting paid to work overtime without actually getting paid for it.
Mr. Monk, we can't even discuss that issue today.
May I discuss this? This is not pertinent.
As a person testifying, you're more than willing to, but you're more than, yes, you can. But I'm saying is that in terms of our discussion today, that is not something that we could discuss.
Right. That's why I'm bringing up the substance, rather than the process. And finally, he apparently agreed that he had conducted himself in that manner. And his defense was that this was standard procedure within the police bureau. And it seems to me that based on what I read in the Oregonian, the history of this case is a history of trying to avoid a public hearing because Sergeant Belanda has proposed to bring before the hearing multiple witnesses to testify to that kind of corruption, including top brass of the police bureau. And if this is the reason why we are here today to discuss how to settle this case without a public hearing, without allowing Sergeant Belanda to bring his witnesses to make his case, then this is the concern that I have as a individual taxpayer. And the reason given that this will save the city money strikes me as exceedingly narrow, because the principle of whether or not there is uninvestigated corruption within the police bureau would seem to be worth investigating regardless of the cost.
Mr. Monk, I just had a senior moment and the light went on. So I just want to say I enjoyed your last book and I shared it with the mayor, who also enjoyed it.
Thank you very much.
In fact, I think I endorsed it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Monk. That's been set over for, what's the date?
That will be heard November 19th in the 9:30 a.m. session.
Now, is that the day before Thanksgiving, perchance?
No, it isn't.
Good. Just want to make sure there's enough people here at council to...
Yeah, I show everyone currently in.
Okay. Let's see. Please read item 1438. And can they read them together, 1438 and 39?
Actually, I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Please read 1438 and 39 together.
Okay. 1438, execute contracts for development of solar electric generation system at the Portland Water Bureau's groundwater pump station facility. 1439, authorize contracts for the development and operation of a photovoltaic system at East Portland Community Center.
Well, thank you, Mayor Potter. Commissioner Saltzman and I asked for these two projects to be pulled off, not because of anything even approaching our prior discussion.
But, I hope not.
But actually for Dan and I to once again try to see whose green is bigger. and
who's
green is bigger. Oh, okay. And in the case of the Water Bureau, we have a, and these folks are going to present both sides, and I'll let Dan talk about 1439, but on 1438, as the council is aware, I think most those at home watching are aware, we are gifted in Portland with two outstanding sources of water. One's, of course, up at Bull Run. The other is the ground fields out along the Columbia River. The primary pumping facility out there also maintains about 5 acres, Mike?
Is it yeah, close to that, 5 to 7 acres.
5 to 7 acres of property that we keep pristine, fenced off, because under that we are drawing potentially lots of water that supplies the entire metropolitan area. And shortly after you assigned the Bureau to me, Mayor Potter, we were out looking at the site and were struck with how perfect of a place that would be for a solar panel field. And as it turns out, would be one of the largest solar panel fields around. And I don't know if you have a stat on that, Mike. How big would it be compared to other ones in the United States?
In the United States, I don't know, but the size that we're proposing right now is probably in the top 10 in Oregon, but that will change very quickly, I think.
Yeah. So this is a very exciting project that I asked to be pulled so you could all hear what it is that our fabulous engineers and employees at the Water Bureau have envisioned, I don't know if you want, Dan, you want to talk first before they start talking about your project.
No, I'm just, you know, I'm really pleased that this is a great example of multiple city bureaus and the private sector working together with the benefits of our community environment to get some real serious solar electric going.
I did notice yours is only solar. His is photovoltaic. Sounds a little bit more high-tech.
Well, we might have to do a little more engineering before we finally approve this project. We cannot be outdone.
But no, it's a great example of bureaus working together to really make some serious dent in the city's energy consumption of non-renewable resources and move it in the other direction. So,
I was curious about the percentage that the photovoltaic systems at the both ground well as well as the East Portland Community Center, what percentage of electricity would supply to those two entities?
Do you have the percent number? I can talk generally, but maybe he knows the percentage.
A percentage of electricity that it is providing to groundwater?
Yes.
It will offset our base load at the facility. I don't have an exact percentage, but all the offices, the computers, lights, treatment equipment will be operated by this facility
everything
over the
but
course
the actual,
of the year.
Everything but the pumps.
Everything but the pumps.
When
right.
the pumps That's kick on, it greatly overwhelms the solar.
Yes.
We actually have to notify PGE when we kick on our pumps to prepare their system to provide that amount of power.
And at EPCC, it'll produce about 12% of the what's needed for the aquatic center.
12%?
Yes.
What is the cost on those two operations then for the to provide this? And do you eventually get it back? I mean, do you get tax credits or
because actually,
how about if we jump into the presentation?
Yeah, we're waiting for questions.
Those are
okay.
Those are excellent questions, but I think we've actually
we do have it covered. We have a short PowerPoint presentation that we'd like to give you at this point in time.
Okay.
But I'll first start. We are excited to be here today to present these solar power generation systems, two of them that are being done for the Water Bureau and for Parks Bureau. And I'm David Peters with the Water Bureau, and I'd like to start there with introductions.
I'm Mike Stewart, Chief Engineer of the Water Bureau.
And I'm Zelaine Nunn with Parks Bureau.
And we have several other folks in the audience that are with us today that have been invaluable in putting this project together. We have Sandra Walden with Commercial Solar Ventures.
Maybe one stand.
Okay. Dave Tews with the Office of Sustainable Development. And Lisa Pedersen with Sarah Architects have also joined us today. And so we're here with the two ordinances to approve all the agreements that were necessary to make these projects come to life. And so that's what we'll be asking for at the end, is your approval of those agreements. But I wanted to make one statement before we move into the presentation itself. This is just the first step in a wider use of solar within the city. The Water Bureau has also taken the lead in developing a citywide RFP, where we're working with Parks, Maintenance, Bureau of Environmental Services to put together an RFP that will be coming out in November for further projects that will be done in 2009. So these are just the first two out of the box to get started with. Mike.
So in some respects, we're kind of like the third grade class that came and talked with us this morning. This is the fourth grade of Solar Venture School. We're hoping to graduate to high school one of these days. Why solar? Both under the direction of both of our respective commissioners early in their supervision of the bureaus, they encourage us to adopt alternative energy strategies, which we've been working on. The Water Bureau has our biodiesel initiative, and we've been searching for a good solar project. And 2 years ago in our sustainability plan, one of our requirements in the sustainability plan was we wanted to be able to produce 100 kilowatts by 2010. And our particular project will produce over 200 kilowatts, and if all goes well, we will have it done before 2010. We also wanted to figure out how to leverage all the incentives that are floating around out in the marketplace right now for solar and sustainable projects, and hence the school part of this exercise. So we sought to capitalize on these incentives. And we also, in the end, wanted to own what it was we built so that we gain the financial benefit of it. Why particularly now? Well, Oregon right now is deep into encouraging solar projects of all types. And what we have capitalized on here is a whole bunch of efforts across the state. We have Energy Trust of Oregon supporting what we're doing, Oregon Department of Energy, the Federal Investment Tax Credit, which we were all on pins and needles for, because the availability of the tax credit makes this thing an economic enterprise for the investor. And I've got a cute little chart to show you how complicated this is in a moment. But we watched as the economy took a little bit of a dive, and then we had investor hesitancy. We're not used to having to worry about that. But we have been counseled by our teacher in this enterprise, Commercial Solar Ventures, to be patient, and we were, sitting on the edge of our chairs. Portland General Electric, who cooperates in hooking the whatever it is we build up to their distribution network. The Bonneville Environmental Foundation, which is a key player in the financial operation of this enterprise, and Office of Sustainable Development. There's two other entities that have helped us with this that aren't sitting here today, and that is we've had the able assistance of our city attorney's office. This required new contract documents for us and looking at risky things we don't normally think about, and also the Bureau of Purchases as we worked our way through a very creative setup for the city. The cute little chart before you is an illustration of how complicated this is. Usually we're pretty simple. For the Water Bureau, we have a water fund and we let a contract, and it's kind of a pretty linear chart. You look here, you see lots of players, Commercial Solar Ventures, who's skilled at putting the financial arrangements together. This is so small, I can hardly read the print myself sitting here. We've got Commercial Solar Ventures here. We got the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, who helps us with financing and all the transfers that have to take place. CSV is a limited liability corporation that sits in the middle of it, and they're a key player. And you can see the rest of the players there. So what we're doing here is learning. That's the school part. And in our case, we're also test driving this small solar project for a much larger one as we proceed with our response to LT2. And if the appeal to Congress doesn't play out, we may very shortly be building a UV plant up in the watershed. And it's our intention to plant a 35-acre solar well field up, or solar cell field photovoltaic cell field, as you choose, up in the watershed that will completely offset the power that's required for the UV plant, which is substantial, about 4 megawatts. So this is kind of a training exercise for us. Other benefits that we will receive from this is we're putting an investment in the local economy. I note that there was a big groundbreaking ceremony in Salem by Sanyo to build the solar cells down in Salem. We used local consultants and local contractors to build these projects. And so I think it's a good deal all around. We're being sustainable and we're supporting our local community. Dave.
As Mike mentioned previously, one of the advantages of the program that we have set up here for these projects is that each bureau will have ownership of the facilities. After about 6 years, those facilities will be turned over to the bureau. And then we will, from that point on, will have the benefit of having the electricity generated from those facilities simply for the cost of our operations. And what we found for the Water Bureau is that over the life of that facility, which is anticipated to be about 30 years, we would have an offset in electrical costs of about $1 million.
Is an offset the same as a net savings of $1 million?
Yeah. Yes, it is. It means we will not have to buy $1 million in electricity over that period of time. The picture in front of you is an aerial view of our groundwater pump station site. That's Airport Way on the north of the photo and the Columbia Slough to the south of that property. And the area in red is an area that is within our fenced boundaries of that property. We have about an acre and a half there that has been unused up to this point in time. With the current design for the photovoltaic solar system, we have shown there what the panels will look like once they're installed on the site. These panels will be mounted on the ground. They'll be sitting just a few feet above the ground surface. This is an example of a 2-megawatt facility that was installed in Colorado to give you an idea of what a ground-mounted facility may look like in the end.
The Parks project's a little different in that it is a rooftop installation. It'll be on the Aquatic Center that's currently under construction at East Portland Community Center. Thanks to our partners, the city will not have any cost for construction of this project. It will then generate power and it'll heat the water at what should be considerable savings to the city in utility costs over the term of the agreement. Another added benefit of this particular project is that because of the installation of this solar facility, we should be able to achieve platinum LEED status at the Aquatic Center. So as far as what's next, the EPCC project is expected to get underway right away, and it should be completed by the end of the year. I believe Waters project should be done in the first quarter or so of 2009. And like David said, Parks is also really excited about the opportunity to do future projects like this, and we thank you for your continued support. Projects like these are great examples of private-public partnerships, like you were saying. And in this case, you know, it enables us to meet some of the city's sustainability goals and to do a project that we probably wouldn't otherwise be able to do. We'd like to thank both Water and Parks, some of the partners who have contributed financially to this, including the Energy Trust of Oregon, Portland General Electric, Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and the private investors. And we'd also really like to thank Sandra Walden from Commercial Solar Ventures, who really, for heroic efforts, really, to pull all this together and pull all the partners together and coordinate every facet of this project.
I think it's safe to say she's actually the brains of this enterprise. So if you, Commissioner Fish always likes to ask, what do we want from you? We hope you vote yes, naturally, on the two ordinances. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions from the commissioners?
Just thank you for the great work on this. This is another exciting project, Mike, that you're shepherding through. So I appreciate you and Dave Peters doing such great work on this stuff. Thank you.
I did have a question about the technology. I was looking at the news the other night and saw, I think PGE was putting up some solar panels on a building. But the solar panel